Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. This hour, Democrats, Religion, and Our Women of Faith series. Now, it is admittedly difficult to bring nuanced political discussion to a debate stage that features, as Andra and I noticed, a dozen candidates. I mean, listen to this.
Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all health care needs.
You don't know that,
second
Bernie.
Of all,
we'll come to you in a second,
I do know, and I wrote the damn bill.
Thank you.
That's what the Democratic... But I want to say more
Thank
about...
Thank you, Ms. Williamson.
Okay,
Thank
I hope
you, Ms.
you'll come
Williamson.
Back to me this time.
Go ahead.
I mean, I just think he needs to...
I never
to...
believed him.
Senator Harris, please respond.
Okay, you get the picture. But I have always found it odd that in election years, there are rarely thoughtful questions or insightful discussions about a topic that is hugely important to many Americans, and that's faith. I mean, think about this. 9 in 10 Americans say they believe in a higher power. That means that belief is a prism through which we view our family lives and our views on issues and our ideas about what it means to be an American. Delaware Senator Chris Coons wrote a piece about this for The Atlantic recently in which he argued that Democratic candidates are making a mistake in hiding away the influence that faith has in their lives. His words. He wrote, Democrats today spend less time showing how our faith and religious backgrounds drive and inform our positions on all kinds of things, immigration, climate change, taxes, health care, out of a largely unspoken concern that publicly connecting faith with politics doesn't quite fit. So we have two guests for this show to talk about that, and I'd love to hear from you, and I know our guests would too. As a voter, Democratic, Republican, Independent, is your faith an important influence in the way you think about a candidate and their ideas for solving America's challenges? Now tell me how much you want to know about a candidate's religious convictions. So as a voter of any political stripe, I want to know if your faith is an important influence in the way you think about an individual candidate or some of the policy ideas they have. And then I want to know how much you want to know about a candidate's religious convictions. What's the time and place for that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the upper Midwest, and on Twitter, of course, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Amy Sullivan is with us. She's a national reporter who covers religion and politics. She co-hosts the Impolite Company podcast, and she's with us today from where are you at, Amy? I don't know that.
I'm in Evanston, Illinois, just outside Chicago.
Really good to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us. Diane Butler Bass is with us, an independent scholar who specializes in religion and culture. She's the author of many books, including Christianity After Religion. It was published in 2012. And she joins us this morning from Duke University. Hi, Diana. How are you?
Well, actually, I'm outside of Washington, D.C.
Oh my
in
gosh.
Alexandria,
okay.
Virginia.
All right. Good to have you, too. Glad both of you can be on the show. So, Amy, I think we have to acknowledge that, and I want to make sure I say this pretty clearly, I think speaking with ease and authenticity about your faith is not easy, and I don't want to suggest that it is for candidates, which is why I remember how some Democrats, since we're talking about primarily why Democrats don't do this, have done it well, and President Obama did it well. Why is this a challenge for many other Democrats?
Well, there are a few kind of good reasons and some bad reasons that it's a challenge for Democrats. One is just the language that we are used to hearing faith discussed with in politics, which is to say that before really the mid-1970s, we didn't really talk about religion and politics together, mm-hmm. with the exception of something like, 1960 when John F. Kennedy ran and was the first Catholic president, and we had some discussion about his Catholicism. But it wasn't until Jimmy Carter that we had a president who really talked openly about his faith as a positive thing, as how it formed him. And ever since then, it's been kind of a white, evangelical, even Southern-inflected language that people expect. So anything other than that kind of doesn't register as faith. Another thing that Democrats have to deal with that Republicans don't is they represent a very diverse base. It's much easier when your base, as it is on the Republican side, tends to be mostly Christian, mostly white, and you can use very kind of explicitly evangelical or conservative religious appeals without fearing that you're going to be turning anybody off. Democrats have a large segment of their base and a growing segment that are people who say they are religiously unaffiliated. Mm-hmm. And I think some professional Democrats think that means people who are antagonistic to faith. They read that as atheist. But in fact, we know that is not true. Many of these people have been turned off from the religion of their childhood, whether it's Catholics who have fallen away over the sex abuse scandals and other reasons, or evangelicals and mainliners who are starting to leave their churches, but maybe still looking for another place. So there are some tricky factors that Democrats deal with. In addition to the fact, if we just want to wrap up with coming back to Barack Obama, who did it very, very well. So much of what worked for him in terms of faith outreach and even how he spoke about faith was its very subtlety, which makes it hard for a lot of Democrats to draw lessons from it because he wasn't standing up and saying, well, as the Bible says in verse
right.
X, Y, Z,
right.
It was under the radar.
You know, I hadn't thought about that faith diversity issue as a part of this, so I'm glad you brought that up, Amy. Let me go to the phones here and take some calls and see what Diana has to say about this. To Kelly in Fargo. Hi, Kelly. How do you think about this intersection of faith and politics?
Well, to me, a candidate's religious conviction is not something that I'm particularly concerned about, being non-religious myself. I am the great-granddaughter of homesteaders to this region, so mm-hmm. Scandinavian Baptist Lutheran, but my parents left the church, and I have not rejoined. And so for me, it's a bit of a turnoff when candidates focus too much on religion. I much prefer to pay attention to the issues at hand and their voting record and such. And especially considering our region and the Indigenous history here, it's really important to me that we take a critical perspective towards how especially Christian religions have impacted people in the region.
Kelly, I'm really glad for your call. I think you've highlighted what Amy and I started talking about. Diana, I'm interested in your thoughts on that now that we've heard from Kelly and Amy on this.
Well, it's interesting that Amy would have brought that up because in January 2013, so it was right after the second Obama election. It was actually his second inaugural address. Mm-hmm. I was really struck by how Obama in that particular speech created what I called in a Washington Post article a civic spirituality. And I think that it serves as that speech in some ways to me serves as a model of what Amy was saying, that Democrats really have to struggle to put together transcendent language that refers to God but also leaves open the space for atheists and agnostics, and that is deeply pluralistic and reaches towards all different sort of threads of American religious experience, which, of course, is what Kelly was pointing to in the call as well. But Obama managed to do that, and it was impressive. And, you know, it really, in a sense, was not all that nuanced. He went back in American history and he literally grabbed hold of moments when Americans had pulled out our best ideals and ideals that were wrapped in our visions of the common good, of what it was beautiful and just, and did refer to God, but did so in ways that were not offensive, and instead left room for many Americans to find themselves. So that kind of talking about religion is still rare, but I don't know that it's rare because it's hard. I think it's rare because we haven't been used to it yet.
I see.
And so I think that if Democrats pay attention to creating a real civic, it's not a civic religion that is based in being Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish anymore, like it was in the middle part of the 20th century, but instead creating a sort of a civic spirituality that holds the space for our multiple visions of what is best in the human spirit and also the transcendent ideals that bind us, that Democrats can move there. And it would be appealing to a person like Kelly because it has room for both celebration and criticism of the past.
Let me say this that I think goes to this before we take another call, that I've been reading some of the things that Michael Weir, President Obama's former faith outreach leader, has said. And he said that there are swing voters who want to hear Democrats talk about how their faith informs their views, the policies that Kelly wants to hear, you know, issues like immigration and voting rights. Because I think it's interesting because you often hear the social justice argument from Democrats. We heard a lot of it in the debates over the last two nights, but we don't hear it as often as a religious argument. But Diana, what I hear you saying is Obama, when you talk about civic spirituality, that Obama did that well, and Michael Weir is, I think, describing that, how that could work.
I think there is a kind of an interesting divide. And, you know, Amy and I have sort of had a little bit of back and forth in really great ways about this over the years, is that there are both sort of people who are very religious Democrats, like Michael, who are making an argument for specifically religious language, including specifically Christian language that would appeal to particularly still white Christian voters in the Midwest who are there by large numbers. Those people are still Christian, which I'm sure you know in Minnesota.
Yes.
There's also this other argument that I've been trying to make, and that is we can honor that and give it space, but also to create a bigger vision. And I think that living in a pluralistic society, which is where we are, where we live in religious pluralism right now, mm-hmm. That it cannot be a distinctly Christian argument about things like abortion or things like social justice, but that it can be an argument that has wider boundaries. And I think we see this in particular. There is a lot of talk in social justice circles right now about, you know, simple principles of loving your neighbor and doing unto others as you would have done to yourself. And those two principles, of course, they're not only from the Christian Bible and Hebrew scriptures and Islamic tradition, but there's elements of those things and specific commands for those things that are found in Buddhism and Hinduism and Zoroastrianism, and there are spiritual equivalents of it in humanism. And so I think that we can appeal to specifics with specific kinds of voters and say, hey, look, we're not hostile to Jesus, or we're not hostile to talking about the Old and New Testaments. But on the other hand, when we are together as a people, we are going to have to go a lot bigger than that.
Isabel says on Twitter, I don't care about a politician's religion or faith. I care about if their stances match with my beliefs. Even identifying with a religion is too broad to tell me anything about your views. Some Christians are supporting refugees while others claim abortion is murder. To the phones to Kat in St. Paul. Hi, Kat. Appreciate you waiting. What'd you want to say?
Thank you. I'm a member of the LGBT community and someone who's been personally harmed by churches I've been a member of in the past.
Mm-hmm.
My partner is Jewish, and we kind of cringe every time we hear Democratic candidates speaking in the language you were referring to, the language of evangelical Christianity. We're not antagonistic to spirituality, but hearing that language makes us far more wary of a candidate, and we do far more work to find out if they are antagonistic
to
who we are.
Yeah, and that comes from your own personal experience with individual faith communities, individual churches?
That absolutely, personally. And then I exist in a community that is currently being assaulted by many members of faith communities. And that's not a generalization that applies to everyone, but that language is so coded that it's hard to separate and feels like it needs a lot of investigation when that topic is brought up by a candidate.
A really good call, Kat. Thank you much. To Matt in Minneapolis. Matt, how do you see this?
Hi. The way I see it is kind of similar to the previous caller, slightly different, though, just from my study of the New Testament. And really, to me, my understanding, you know, in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus explicitly tells his followers, you know, don't make a big deal out of your faith in public, because that's going to lead to hypocrisy. And, you know, really, if you're going to have a relationship with the divine, the purest way to have that is to kind of, in a sense, keep it to yourself or within your own community, but to go around kind of making a, basically, the modern term would be virtue signaling, is not only going to be come off as insincere to a lot of people, but also it's going to really do damage to your own relationship with the divine, because it's going to become a public thing rather than something that's a genuine interior relationship. So I guess for me, and maybe this is in the minority, because I do know that there's a lot of Christians who like to hear a politician kind of pander to them. But to me, I think really the essence of a true spirituality is to really, as much as possible, keep it private. And I think people who are of genuine faith will respect a candidate and really see them as someone with a lot of integrity if they do just say, you know, publicly, listen, I do have a relationship with God, but I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
You know, I think that's what people are hoping to hear.
Lots to talk about there, Matt. Thank you. I want to hear what Amy Sullivan has to say about this idea that hearing a candidate talk about faith feels like some kind of breach of privacy in some ways. I think that's what Matt's bringing up. And this idea that Kat called in to talk about the coded language and what it reveals or conceals.
With faith in God, with fidelity to country.
Christ is the center of my life. I believe in that radical love.
The story for me is Matthew 26.
You know, the imagery of Christ when the divine comes to earth as being in a servant mode. It comes from my community.
That's what Democratic candidates sound like when they're talking about faith. And we're talking about where faith and politics intersect in our latest Women of Faith series. Diana Butler-Bass with us and Amy Sullivan. And Amy, let me come to you before we go into some of the more calls here, because we heard from Kat and Matt both kind of bringing up this idea of a breach of privacy when a candidate talks about their relationship with a higher power. And how do I really understand the coded language that's often used when politicians talk about religion? Some thoughts on that, if you would.
Yeah, I think that many, many Americans agree with them that religion should be private. I think it's a reason a lot of Democratic politicians have really stayed away from talking about their faith in the past, is they say it's not something I should wear on my sleeve. But unfortunately, politics is not performed in a vacuum. And it's been the tendency of Democrats to be private that has allowed conservatives to, I believe, unfairly paint them not as just secular and a-religious, but as actually actively opposed to religion. And that's been something that has really hurt Democrats over the past few decades, and it's getting worse. The other thing is that Democrats do have a tendency to sound very technocratic when they're talking about plans and policies. And one thing that voters across the spectrum are looking for is a sense of values. Now, that doesn't have to be religious values. We have often used religion as a proxy for kind of gauging the moral compass of candidates. But if you look at somebody like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, one of the reasons I think they have gotten so much grassroots support is that they can talk about their plans, but they also have this righteous anger. You know that they are placing it within a value system, and they are able to summon this secular language that expresses a really righteous sense of what is right and wrong.
I think what you're saying fits with something that Delaware Senator Chris Coons wrote about this in The Atlantic recently. He got a lot of feedback, by the way, on this piece. He writes, it's not about citing one scripture verse or another to argue for a certain policy. It's about letting those Americans for whom religion is central to their lives know that we understand them, respect them, and in many cases, share their religious backgrounds. Diana, does that fit with what you hear Amy saying? Again, it is not chapter and verse from the Bible. It's seeding your views inside some kind of moral compass that derives from your belief in a higher power.
What Amy said, I think, was incredibly smart and to the point. And the piece that I would want to sort of add into that goes back to Kat's question on the phone about LGBTQ rights and her fears. One of the interesting and really untold stories in American religion and politics in the last decade was the shift towards American acceptance of marriage equality. And, you know, a lot of that happened because gay activists were on the street, and you know, Human Rights Campaign and a lot of organizations did amazingly hard social justice work, no doubt about it. But the other piece of that story is that major church bodies in the United States took that issue on to the threat of destroying their own denominations in order to work to help their members understand the full humanity of gay and lesbian, transgender, bisexual people, and to argue for the full access to marriage for all Americans.
We saw that in Minnesota.
Yeah. And what happened was the policy shifted on the ground as the churches made the argument. And that story has not really been told. And because the other story has been told for the exact reasons Amy said, is that Democrats are afraid to talk about that story. But it's a real story, and it's a powerful story about people who were religious people who took real risks and who divided their churches and divided their denominations for the sake of justice for people that they felt had been treated terribly by the culture. And so that's part of the story, too. Yet there's not been space to talk about it.
Kevin,
and because we've given the sort of the microphone to the religious right when it comes to faith and politics.
Kevin says on Twitter, speaking as a former evangelical and Republican, I don't care to know about any of the candidates' faith. It's fine if they want to talk about it. It won't influence my decision. Also, I don't equate faith with morality. To Alima in Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Alima. Good to have you on the line. What are you thinking about?
I've been thinking through this whole discussion about the First Amendment that says you can't make a religious test for anyone for public office. And I'm old enough to remember before Jimmy Carter started talking about his religion and how talking about John F. Kennedy was completely out of the norm to talk about his religion because his religion was out of the norm. And I'm thinking that the previous caller talking about the fight for gender equality and things like that. My church, people from the church across the street left and came over and joined my church because their church wasn't going to go for it. And I think we have to be willing to leave our faith communities if their teachings don't equate with what I call moral reality, which is, we're all okay. we're all good people and we don't have to buy our way into office with our religion.
Alima, I heard from Mallory, who I think has some similar concerns on this. She writes, you know why that question shouldn't come up in the debates? Because I was saying this morning, here's something that was never mentioned in all these hours of debates. Mallory adds, because church and state are supposed to be separate. Their faith or lack of one shouldn't matter. Amy, what do we do with that? That is a belief a number of voters hold and politicians have been called on to speak to. What should we understand about it?
Well, I think as a journalist, I think that is something that needs to be directed to the people who are asking the questions, because I do agree there's been a sudden interest in Democrats and religion, and some of that is good because, as I said earlier, it was inaccurate to paint for decades the parties as Republicans were the people of faith and Democrats were the people opposed to faith or who wanted to keep it out of the public square. But that doesn't mean that it's appropriate to just quiz Democrats on their faith beliefs or their traditions. It really has to be connected to why it should be relevant for voters. And it's very rare that you get journalists who can ask smart questions about that.
Maybe you guys need to be on the debate panels, or the moderator panels. How about that?
Can I ask Amy a quick question?
Sure.
You know, Amy, I'm really interested in this idea that was brought up by the last caller that, you know, there's a separation of church and state and there was no religious test for office. And all that's true, but I'm trained as a historian, and it seems like from the angle of history, we had a de facto test for a really long time. And that was, we just assumed that the people who were running for office were Christians. And not only Christians, but Protestant Christians. And that's why 1960 was so important. It was like, oh my gosh, a Catholic? How could a Catholic possibly run for office? And so when you move into, it seems to me, and I'm curious about how you report on this, because when you move into being truly a nation of religious pluralism, isn't it part of the critique that we have to make is to get rid of the de facto establishment and to be able to talk easily and openly about faith or non-faith or, you know, if we come from some, you know, spiritual tradition. I mean, I think that in some ways this is the controversy that's being raised around Marianne Williamson. You know, people are freaking out because she's so far out of the normal religious box, but she's also completely comfortable talking about it. And so I'm just sort of fascinated about this idea of the de facto establishment dying and something new emerging.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that history. And it is kind of a historical oddity that just at the moment that the U.S. was becoming more ethnically pluralistic and certainly religiously pluralistic, Watergate happened. And I think that that is really what started the modern political discussion of faith, because voters realized, oh, it wasn't enough to just assume that their president had a moral compass. Like they had to have some way of actually locking that down and knowing it for sure. And obviously you can't do that. But the first candidate to come along after Watergate was Jimmy Carter, who just talked about being born again and had this very evangelical language. And people kind of grabbed onto that as a way to perceive the moral character of a president. And I think that's unfortunate because it's just one way, and it's maybe even the most irresponsible way to judge something like that. And yet it has really dictated how people discuss things that I think absolutely belong in politics in terms of the values that we hold as a country. And it's again, coming back to Barack Obama, a reason why he was so successful is he could say something like, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper. And he doesn't have to say that's from the Old Testament. It fits into the larger narrative that he was telling about not being a red America or a blue America, but the United States of America. And a successful candidate will be one who can do that.
We have a caller who wants to follow up on what we've been saying about Obama to Sarah in Minneapolis. Sarah, what are you interested in when it comes to Obama and some of the other candidates?
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to weigh in or anything, but I was curious to know what your experts thought about how Mayor Pete compares to President Obama in terms of subtlety. I know you guys were talking about how President Obama was very good at being subtle about all of this. And in the beginning of all of this, too, Mayor Pete was pretty vocal, but it seems like he treads a pretty balanced line of how he handles it and when he talks about it. So it's just curious what they thought.
It's such a good question because he is the reason that we're doing the show the way we are, the comfort that he has with talking about faith. We have a cut here from Mayor Pete Buttigieg on The View talking about faith.
When I go to church and the scripture that I hear, it is about protecting the poor. It is about looking after those who are marginalized in society. There's a lot about welcoming the stranger, which to me includes welcoming the immigrant. And, you know, so much of what Christ's teachings are about have to do with the way that we take care of the least among us. And I see now in the White House this celebration of how powerful you can be and how rich you can be, as if that's the same thing as virtue. But I think for those of us who think that our morality is something that needs to be in touch with our religious faith personally, then it's really important to explain that this is not, no one party has a monopoly on faith.
Diana, is he getting it just right, given what we've talked about this morning?
Well, I think he is. And I also think that's what propelled him into the national conversation. When a gay man who is a Midwestern mayor, who's also a soldier, could come out and talk like that yeah. about the Bible. My husband, who is a political junkie and always has been, he says he will pay big money if Pete Buttigieg is the vice presidential candidate and debates Mike Pence. he wants to see that one.
Amy, do you concur with Diana that this is part of the curiosity and the interest about how Pete Buttigieg and the comfort that he has in talking about these values and virtues and religious faith is part of the reason that we are talking about him?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't teach that. But I also think there's something even more simple, which is, you know, a couple of your callers have referenced the fact that Christianity in particular has a really bad history in oppressing women and oppressing LGBTQ sisters and brothers. And when Mayor Pete stands up as a gay man and just says, I was married in my church, in an instant, he blows away the idea that you can either be for gay rights or for religion.
Wow. Yeah.
Or, you know, extending it further, that you have to choose. Right. You could be for women or you can be for religion. In his person, he combines both of those and kind of blows away that stereotype.
Lori says on Twitter, I appreciate the way Pete Buttigieg discusses faith as moral responsibility. I think where faith becomes problematic is when it's prescriptive on birth control, LGBTQ issues, and even whether a man should be alone with a woman who's not his wife. And of course, Amy, what do they call that again? It's the something, something.
Billy Graham.
The Billy Graham rule.
Yep.
Okay, yeah. Yuck. To the phones, to Adam in Hudson, Wisconsin.
We know what Amy thinks of that.
And what I think of it. To Adam in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hey, Adam, hi. What are you thinking about?
Hi, just a general comment, which is that I see some conflation between the concept of anti-establishment, which is in the Constitution, and the idea of a wall of separation between church and state, which my understanding is a Jeffersonian principle, something Thomas Jefferson wrote about in some letter at some point. And for me, it's a little bit frustrating. I'm a religious person, and I feel like this wall of separation a lot of people believe is a constitutional idea that prohibits, you know, using religion as a basis for some sort of an opinion or philosophy or morality or whatever, when in a democracy it's perfectly legitimate to base your political decisions on some sort of religious belief, as long as it doesn't actually establish a state religion.
Right, exactly.
And so I think that, you know, people should be free and open about their religious beliefs if they have them, and that it shouldn't really be something that they have to defend as anti-constitutional or something like that.
No, really, really well said. I mean, there's the misunderstanding, Diana. What the Constitution is guarding against is the state deciding there is one religion, not that you can be a politician whose religion informs their views and talk really openly about that. Do you think that's where the misunderstanding is?
Well, the caller articulated the argument. That is what Americans have been arguing about for 200 and almost 50 years now when it comes to these ideas. You know, is how thick is the wall? How high is the wall? Is the wall in the Constitution? Is there something else? And I will never forget 30 years ago sitting in a graduate school classroom, and a very well-esteemed expert on religion and politics said, as he lectured the class, that the wall of separation has more often been a picket fence.
Huh. It's a good image.
And it is a great image, and I've carried it with me ever since. And that is really true, is that we have these theories. How they work out in reality is messy, and that's what it means to be an American, is to argue over this. I mean, that's a big part of it. And, yeah, it's more like a picket fence.
Diana, you wrote a piece that I read where you talked about the fact that there's a breach in your own family over President Trump and the fact that you and your brother grew up in a Methodist household, but you express your religion quite differently. Is it still the case that you haven't communicated since Charlottesville?
Yes, it is. It's very painful. You know, it's there's not too much to say other than what I wrote for the CNN piece, is that we had a big argument when he defended the white supremacist protesters and actually said some things that I thought were quite horrible. And it got to the point where I couldn't be quiet anymore and just sit there and listen to what he was saying. And I said that he was wrong and our parents would be ashamed of him, which I think is probably true. And he cut me off completely and has not talked to me since then.
I know there's a lot of families that are in your same situation. Hey, thank you both very much for being on the show, and I am hoping our conversations can continue. I'd love to have you both back. Thank you much.
Please do.
Just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.